Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to this annual lecture in Law and Society, sponsored by the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society in affiliation with the Centre for Social Legal Studies in the University. So it's my pleasure to welcome you and to welcome our guest lecturer tonight, Professor Sheila Jasanoff. Professor Jasanoff is the Pforzheimer Professor of Science and Technology at Harvard in the Kennedy School. She's previously held posts at numerous universities, and her writings extend very widely. Her writings and research and teaching include science and technology in the law and in relation to democracy and public policy, and also issues of globalization and the challenges of globalization. Professor Jasanoff is no stranger to Oxford. She has spent time here before. Indeed, quite some years ago, it must be at least 10 years ago, was a visiting fellow at the Centre for Social Legal Studies. So it's a great pleasure to welcome Sheila back tonight. We look forward to her lecture. There was a, should I mention your little mishap? There won't be any fireworks tonight because of a certain little incident, but there will be a lecture, fortunately. Almost wasn't. Before Sheila, I hand over to Sheila, could I just remind the audience that tomorrow there is a workshop which will follow the lecture, build on the lecture and discuss related issues that go beyond the lecture. I think there are still some places available if anyone would like to be come at this stage. It's being held here in St. Hugh's. And if you would like to enroll, that sounds rather more formal than it's meant to be. If you'd like to come, perhaps you could just let Judy Niner have your name. Well, on that note, I'll hand over to you, Sheila. And once again, welcome very much back to Oxford.
Dennis, thank you for the kind introduction and also for the invitation. It's an enormous honor and privilege to be asked to give the annual lecture, this year's annual lecture in Law and Society in Oxford by the Centre for Sociolegal Studies and the Foundation on Law, Justice and Society. As Dennis mentioned, it's a special pleasure for me personally because as only a very few in this audience are aware, Wolfson College and the Center for Sociolegal Studies nurtured my very first forays into the study of science and law, an area of inquiry that was as little known or noticed at that time as the budding young scholar attempting to define and shape it. I wrote a good part of my first real book, The Fifth Branch, in 1986, the first time I was a visiting fellow at the center before Dennis's time. And I also started research then that led almost 10 years later to my next book, Science at the Bar. Tonight's invitation provides eloquent evidence that the topic I've spent years helping to define as a legitimate area of scholarly inquiry has in some sense arrived on the map of sociolegal studies, even if it remains still on the margins of full academic visibility. In tonight's talk, I'll say a little bit about why it has proved difficult to carve out a space for critical scholarship on science and the law. I'll demonstrate some of the gains in our understanding of both truth and justice if we take that scholarly enterprise seriously. And above all, I'll hope to leave you with a sense of excitement about the insights that open up if we take seriously the observation that law, no less than science, defines our understandings of nature and the natural. That last aim may take some persuasion because it cuts against all conventional wisdom. Earlier this year, for example, I was invited to speak at a conference entitled Legal Doubt, Scientific Certainty. Those very pairings suggest that science, not law, provides the reliable knowledge platforms that tell us how things are. Science settles the facts of the matter, whereas law only sows doubt. Tacitly, the symposium title evokes a mantra that students of science policy learn on the very first day of their entry into the field. Science, and this is the phrase, speaks truth to power. By characterizing the world as it is, science, according to this account, helps guide our judgments about how the world ought to be. By removing uncertainties about how things are, science strengthens our resolve about the way we should craft our rules and behaviors. In short, science informs how we should make law and what law we should make. This is what science in its ideal state is supposed to do for and to the law. That belief, as I say, is a cornerstone of the way many of us think, as children of the Enlightenment, but that is the belief I want to take apart and to problematize. American law's reliance on science for certainty is as old as the Republic itself and as deep as the Republic's Constitution. Of course, the word science has changed its meaning in the years since the American nation was born, but not the notion that there are truths of nature for us to learn and to be led by, especially under conditions of doubt and uncertainty. When the Founding Fathers declared their nation's independence from British rule on the 4th of July, 1776, they turned to the laws of nature to justify what seemed a radical step in terms of law made merely by humans. Every American schoolchild is taught the resonant words that they used to frame their rebellion. When, in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. Here, a people's entitlement to be free, to assume a separate and equal place among other peoples, is seen as dictated by natural law, which is also God's law. It is only natural, the Declaration suggests, that people should liberate themselves from a ruler's arbitrary and despotic acts, such as refusing to legislate the public will, denying people representation, and showing no respect for their legislative bodies. It's appropriate for the law itself to follow what nature dictates. Natural law, construed in this way, underwrote the founders' basic assumptions about the American people's unalienable rights, their entitlement to legislative representation, and the relations of accountability that were deemed to be needful between them and their government. That was then, this is now. The natural law tradition has been radically transformed since the late 18th century. Where the Declaration of Independence turned to nature's God to defend an act of political sedition, 21st century legal practitioners are more likely to speak of science and to derive authority for legal decisions from scientific expertise, claims, and evidence. The entanglement between law and science has increased dramatically in the last 200 years, and across the entire spectrum of legal decision-making, it has become usual to incorporate presumed facts about nature into the law's normative rulings. Science serves as an indispensable resource for the law across an ever-widening spectrum of controversies, including, looking ahead to tomorrow's workshop, many that involve complex litigation, products liability, medical malpractice, environmental controversies, criminal prosecutions, intellectual property, antitrust, and race or gender discrimination, to name but the most obvious contentious domains. The result is a relationship of institutional dependence in which the law repeatedly calls upon science to support and strengthen its own authority. Curiously, as dependence has grown, so has the law's uncertainty about its capacity to use science well or wisely. When I first started working on law and science, most leading thinkers considered the very idea of a science court, for example, to be anathema. Even the use of special masters or other specialist scientific advisers to the judge in complex cases was considered dangerous. Dangerous from the standpoint of doing justice, dangerous because it upset a constitutional order in which the ultimate fact-finding power rested with the jury. In the wake of the tumults of the 1960s, people feared that experts in white coats might take over the function of judges in black robes and lead back to the rule by meritocracy that had given us Hiroshima, Silent Spring, and Vietnam. But history marches on, and those earlier anxieties have lately given place to equally worried ruminations about how the law misuses science. Today, we hear much more about the inadequacy of legal fact-finding, the technical illiteracy of juries and judges, and the law's willingness to buy into scientific claims that would not pass muster with trained expert communities. Powerful narratives of institutional weakness have emerged from this set of concerns, and I'd like to name and briefly describe four of them. They are law lag, culture clash, crisis, and deference. As I discuss each narrative, I'd also like to point out how the storyline suits the law's own need for authority. Paradoxically, by ceding certainty to science, the law enhances its own authority in subtle ways. This is the phenomenon that I refer to as co-production. It is a powerful, pervasive mechanism in society by which our ideas of what is and our judgment of what should be continually intertwine and reinforce one another. The first of these narratives, the law lag, can be traced back to the influential early 20th century American sociologist William F. Ogburn, who argued that interconnected cultural institutions such as science and law develop at uneven paces so that the slower ones necessarily are out of step with the quicker. Different rates of innovation, accumulation, and diffusion among leading and lagging institutions produce a constant need for adjustment, said Ogburn. In 1933, as chair of the President's Research Committee on Social Trends, appointed by Herbert Hoover, Ogburn prepared a report identifying irregular change as the chief source of social problems and advocating for better statistical data as the basis for solving them. You hear echoes of evidence-based policy that is so popular in many quarters today. Reviewing Ogburn's contribution a half century later, however, the sociologist Neil Smelser rejected the suggestion that science inevitably leads the law. Smelser noted that even in Brown v. Board of Education, the U.S. Supreme Court's landmark decision on school desegregation, much touted input from the social sciences did not lead or alter legal thought. It only helped substantiate a moral consensus that had been building for years. Still, the perception that the law lags behind advances in science and technology dominates academic and popular writing and frequently surfaces in legal opinions. In our time, it has come to seem an article of truth that science and technology are the swift-moving sources of innovation, whereas the law is conservative, easily outdated, and produces a drag on the smooth progress of technological innovation. That narrative circulates widely, if at times subliminally, in writing and thinking about the law. As one concrete illustration, I offer a headline from the New York Times in 2001. In genetic testing for paternity, law often lags behind science. So the law lag metaphor is there captured in the terminology of the headline itself. Similarly, in 1980, in the widely cited U.S. life patenting decision, Diamond versus Chakrabarty, Chief Justice Warren Burger observed, and I quote, "Legislative or judicial fiat as to patentability will not deter the scientific mind from probing into the unknown any more than Canute could command the tides." Extending patents to this new domain thus was robed in the garb of inevitability. Nothing in the opinion suggests that this case actually marked a moment of exceptional legal inventiveness when the court in effect created a novel type of commodity and thereby opened the door to new forms of hype and hope, investment and discovery with tremendous consequences for society. We may note, too, that the court created or reinforced a social fact through its own rhetoric, that of the scientific mind which will not stop in its ceaseless quest for knowledge, regardless what barriers the law puts in its way. Needless to say, this was not evidence-based social science in its most robust or reliable incarnation. It was an instance of the law making an image of science that suited its contingent, case-specific purposes. Less deterministic than the law lag narrative is the framework of the culture clash. This, too, casts the aims of the two institutions, law and science, as antithetical, and thus puts the law in the weaker position with regard to knowledge-making. The clash is often described in binaries. For example, science is committed to progress, whereas the law's primary concern is with process. The legal system errs and perhaps intensifies disagreement. Science pursues the determination of consensual reality, come what may. A third narrative, invoked to frame law-science relations, particularly in the United States, is that of crisis. This can be seen as an extreme and highly reductive version of the clashing cultures narrative, one that depicts the relationship between the two institutions as pathological in its failure to produce socially beneficial outcomes. Tocqueville, we remember, presciently observed that in America, political conflicts are routinely translated into legal ones. Ironic, then, that this very nation, founded on law, engages in periodic hand-wringing over its tendency to settle issues through contestation rather than cooperation. This litigious society has been blamed for the spiraling costs of medical insurance, and more specifically, for a malpractice crisis resulting from irresponsible lawsuits and runaway jury awards against physicians. A counter-narrative of sorts, substantiated by much literature and health policy, holds that although only a small fraction of those filing claims have been negligently injured, it is also true that only a small fraction of those who have been injured ever file claims. Further, the rise and fall of insurance premiums may have more to do with cycles in investment by insurance companies than with malpractice claims. Yet the images of a litigation explosion and of uncontrollable jury verdicts persist with die-hard energy despite years of countervailing quantitative research. It seems that our society needs that image of crisis to stoke political support for reforms that raise the bar against litigation and therefore, following Tocqueville, against American politics itself. A recent example is the attempt to use federal preemption doctrine to bar state actions against manufacturers of products that have been regulated and approved by federal agencies based on what is often called scientific risk assessment. For some, the crisis narrative centers less on the economic costs of litigation than on the costs to science itself. Law, according to these critics, encourages the production of junk science, science that cannot meet the scientific community's minimum standards of validity, even though it passes credibility tests with judges, and even more with juries. Proponents of this view attribute the law's uncritical reception of scientific claims to many factors, among them lay ignorance and confusion, mercenary and unprofessional expert witnessing, lax admissibility standards, and lawyers' ethos of privileging victory above the truth. The rhetoric of junk science rests, in short, on a tacit and one-sided sociology of knowledge that differs substantially from the epistemological accounts of scholars in the sociology and politics of science. The junk science narrative is a powerful contribution to what has been called the sociology of error, the tendency in our society to analyze what we see as deviant or a fall from grace, but not to bring an equally critical eye to bear on the groundings of truth or power. What the junk science narrative has lacked in methodological rigor, it has made up for in political persuasiveness. In the 1990s, this line of criticism laid the conceptual groundwork for the fourth of the interpretive frames I'd like to discuss, namely deference, specifically deference by courts toward science and scientists. The 1993 Supreme Court decision in Daubert versus Merrill Dow Pharmaceuticals announced that judges should act as gatekeepers in contests over the admissibility of scientific evidence. Their task should be to make sure that only evidence meeting scientific standards of validity and reliability is admitted to the courtroom. Although judges already had the power to exclude expert testimony under the federal rules of evidence, Daubert took that rarely exercised prerogative and transformed it into an affirmative obligation. To guide judges in discriminating between valid and invalid science, the Supreme Court offered four criteria: testability, peer review, error rate, and general acceptance. These, according to Justice Harry Blackmun, Daubert's chief author, were meant to guide thought, not act as a checklist. But in practice, they have, of course, functioned precisely as a checklist, adding to the technical means by which courts in evidentiary contexts make the science that judges wish to believe in. But was Daubert good law? That depends in part on what we think of the underlying master narrative of junk science. That narrative rests on a series of unstated and largely untested claims about the relationship between scientific knowledge and legal knowledge. And here are some of those presumptions. The facts needed to resolve legal disputes are available on the shelves of science at the time that legal disputes come into being. Second, science produces legally relevant facts in an environment of impartiality and neutrality that is missing in litigation contexts where the adversarial culture prevails. Third, cross-examination is not as effective as peer review in separating good science from bad. And fourth, finding scientific truth is a necessary precursor to rendering justice in cases where the facts are disputed and unsettled. These assertions have been repeatedly shown to rest on weak ground. Legal controversies often arise precisely because the facts that gave rise to them are unique, contingent, and hard to pin down. Legal disputes are situated in specific, unrepeatable social and natural contexts that could not have been imagined by science, let alone served as fruitful objects of scientific curiosity. Who could have imagined, for example, that the innocent-seeming plastic threads attached to the contraceptive device called the Dalkon Shield were a trap for life-threatening bacteria? Who knew what health damage could be caused by silicone gel from ruptured breast implants when such devices had been entered into commerce with no prior testing? What medical science thought to monitor the health effects of chemical cocktails on children at Love Canal in New York or Woburn in Massachusetts? To turn the page back in time, in 1923, when an intrepid Harvard psychologist proposed that a device for measuring blood pressure could show whether a defendant was lying or telling the truth, what body of prior knowledge existed to prove or disprove his claim? And when DNA typing technology was first introduced into criminal prosecution in the 1980s, what steps had been taken to assure that labs would conduct those tests or statisticians interpret their results responsibly? The answer, of course, is that in each of these cases, it was the legal setting that opened up an inquiry into the facts, however bizarre, unique, instructive, or socially consequential those facts may have been. Law created the niche for new science. If this is the normal ordering of knowledge and legal controversy, that controversy precedes the production of relevant facts, it is difficult to claim that science has ready-made answers to pressing legal problems that may affect the life of a single criminal defendant or the health, happiness, and liberty of many thousands. It is the partnership of science and law that produces legally relevant facts in these cases, and insisting on getting the science right addresses only half of that partnership. Well, why does any of this matter? Any trained lawyer is familiar, even comfortable, with the idea of legal fictions, those simplifying heuristics that make it easier to get to decisions and end disputes. What's wrong with believing that science does furnish an adequate degree of truth to support sensible moral choices? Doesn't it make lawyering and judging easier at no great cost? In the second part of this lecture, I'd like to argue that the law's reliance on an external, truth-telling, reliable science is not an innocent fiction. It not only ignores and overlooks important epistemological concerns about science's own claims to facticity, but it also sets aside precisely those normative concerns that should be the core preoccupations of the law. I'll illustrate these risks with several examples from patents on life, environmental law, from the recent politics of the death penalty, and from the emerging alliance between law and neuroscience. So my first example is called Making Mice. There are two kinds of mice in the world today. There are the little animals that lurk in our cellars and subways that serve as prey for cats and in well-bred form as pets for small children. These are the creatures that Robert Burns immortalized as wee, sleek-eyed, cowering, timorous beasties. Then there are the mice made to serve the instrumental purposes of scientific and medical research, standardized mice with mysterious designations such as BALB/C, C57BL C3H or DBA/2, all bred with characteristics such as proneness to certain types of cancer. The former cannot be patented, while the latter can, at least in most countries of the world. That we draw this distinction is a consequence of the law and of the law's involvement in co-production. The patentability of living organisms was first recognized by law in the United States in the case I've already mentioned, the 1980 decision of Diamond versus Chakrabarty. It was in this case that a 5-4 majority of the court propounded the criterion that separates the patentable world of manufactured life from non-patentable nature. To be patentable under U.S. law, a discovery or invention has to meet 4 criteria. It must be within the definition of statutory subject matter, that is, it must belong to the class of things that are in principle patentable. In addition, it must also be new, useful, and non-obvious. The line between what is natural and hence not patentable and what is invented and therefore patentable has shifted over the years to add more entities to the invention side of the ledger. Animals, plants, genes, antibodies, and even mathematical algorithms are now deemed patentable. Only the most elemental phenomena, such as electricity or gravity, are today regarded as distinctly not patentable. Chakrabarty marked a moment of co-production when the law's role in making new kinds of things was openly on view. At issue in the case was a new bacterium produced by Ananda Chakrabarty, an Indian-born researcher working at General Electric. The court was asked whether a bacterium, a living thing, could be patented under the terms of the U.S. Patent Act, a law drafted by Thomas Jefferson. In saying yes, the Chakrabarty Court construed the law's subject matter provision broadly to include, in words that the majority took from a congressional report, anything under the sun that is made by man. So that phrase, anything under the sun that is made by man, became the criterion. If something resulting from human tinkering could not have existed in nature, then it is, in principle, patentable. Later, the Patent Office extended Chakrabarty's holding to higher life forms, including mice. The first mouse to be patented is sometimes called the Harvard mouse. It was a mouse genetically engineered at Harvard to be specially susceptible to cancer and thus suitable for testing drugs for cancer treatment. Even for complex organisms, it did not matter what fraction of the re-engineered construct had previously been designed by nature. All that mattered was that a new thing had been created through human intervention. A change in a single gene could carry a higher animal over the line from non-patentable nature to patentable artifice. When the mouse patent was granted in 1988, the New York Times, voice of the U.S. liberal establishment, editorialized in support of patenting higher order life, saying it was the wrong place to address ethical concerns. That position read patent law as being solely technical, relating only to the bright line between natural and human-made things. Patentability, according to this way of looking at things, was not a matter of ethical judgment, but rather about legally ascertainable facts. The argument against patenting in Chakrabarty was that the claimed subject matter, in this case Chakrabarty's bacterium, was sufficiently new and different from anything previously deemed patentable to require explicit congressional authorization. This meant that novelty was working in two different ways in the same case. On the one hand, Dr. Chakrabarty's patent could not be granted unless the invention was deemed new and non-obvious. Only by rewarding true novelty could the law claim to be advancing the legislature's intent to promote ingenuity. On the other hand, the invention could not be regarded as so radically new that it fell outside the range of things that Congress had already defined as patentable 200 years before. The majority got around this dilemma by construing as natural the creation of things not found in nature. To innovate was not in itself to be considered novel. For example, the court noted a rule that unanticipated inventions are without patent protection would conflict with the core concept of the patent law. Chakrabarti's invention was held in this way to be unanticipated enough to merit protection. At the same time, the process of making it was continuous enough with normal processes of invention to require no new legislative deliberation. The Canadian Supreme Court's 2002 decision to refuse a patent on the Harvard oncomouse helps us understand more clearly what was non-obvious or not to be taken for granted in Chakrabarti and subsequent patent decisions on life. By the time that case came to the Supreme Court of Canada, Harvard held patents on both the oncomouse and the process of modifying it in Europe, the US, Japan, and New Zealand. The Canadian court became the first to deny the product patent on the oncomouse. Five justices for the majority found differently from Chakrabarti on two counts. Should a higher organism, such as a mouse, be considered a composition of matter? And was it deference to Parliament, or was it flouting parliamentary intent to refuse patent protection to higher organisms? The first issue is most important to my argument about law and co-production, and that is where I'll focus. The court was convinced that the term composition of matter could not encompass something so complex as a living animal, and that altering one gene in an animal's genome is not equivalent to producing an entirely new composition. Justice Michel Bastarache, writing for the majority, ringingly repudiated this sort of genetic reductionism, and his words are quite interesting for us to reflect on. So I quote, "Higher life forms are generally regarded as possessing qualities and characteristics that transcend the particular genetic material of which they are composed. A person whose genetic makeup is modified by radiation does not cease to be him or herself. Likewise, the same mouse would exist absent the injection of the oncogene into the fertilized egg cell. It simply would not be predisposed to cancer. The fact that it has this predisposition to cancer that makes it valuable to humans does not mean that the mouse, along with other animal life forms, can be defined solely with respect to the genetic matter of which it is composed. The fact that animal life forms have numerous unique qualities that transcend the particular matter of which they are composed makes it difficult to conceptualize higher life forms as mere compositions of matter. It is a phrase that seems inadequate as a description of a higher life form." In his vigorous dissent, Justice Binney wrote, "I do not think that a court is a forum that can properly debate the mystery of mouse life. But a refusal to debate this point in court would have amounted to a judgment that the issue was not debatable at all. Indeed, in the light of U.S. experience, it was not likely to be debated in any other forum than the court. Binney's position would therefore also have let stand a particular solution to the mystery of mouse life, eliding any legally relevant difference between higher animals and compositions of matter." The upshot of Justice Bastarache's thinking is that the extension of mechanical invention to living creatures that had seemed so natural to the thin majority in Chakrabarti in 1980 struck an equally thin majority of the Canadian justices as unnatural in 2002. There was, in short, nothing intrinsically natural about the U.S. Supreme Court's naturalization of the process of invention. In each case, the line drawn between nature and artifice reflected judicial visions both of how nature works and of the court's own institutional role. My second example is called making clean air. What could be more natural than the air we breathe? Yet, seen as a composition of matter in its own right, the very air around us is a product of intense human activity, encompassing our capacity for both legal and scientific imagination. So, a visitor to Berlin in the summer of 2005 would have noticed a new sign in the buses comprising part of the city's impeccable transportation system. "Berlin atmet auf," declared the decal on many bus windows. "Wir ziehen Feinstaub aus dem Verkehr." Somewhat freely translated, that means Berlin breathes free, we draw fine particulates out of traffic or perhaps out of circulation, that public transport should advertise itself as beneficial to public health is perhaps not altogether surprising in our environmentally and energy-conscious times, and the contribution of vehicular traffic to urban air pollution hardly needs comment, especially so close to London. And the contribution of... But what is this entity called Feinstaub that in 2005 all educated Berliners were supposed to recognize at a glance? How did it come to occupy their conceptual world? And is it, in the philosopher Ian Hacking's terms, a thing in nature, a natural kind, or a thing in society, an interactive or social kind? Before proceeding with a fuller inquiry into the nature of fine particulates or Feinstaub, let us remind ourselves of the basis for Hacking's distinction between natural and social kinds. Hacking is a constructivist who happily concedes that the objects and ideas disclosed through science have histories, and yet he is also a realist who believes that nature at some point takes over. Natural kinds, like particulates, are simply there. So, as he once said, the idea of quarks may have a history, and I quote, but quarks, the objects themselves, are not constructs, are not social, are not historical. Natural kinds, like quarks, are indifferent to us and what we may think about them. Calling a quark makes no difference to the quark. They bear none of their history about them, as Hacking added. They just are. Feinstaub, or its U.S. equivalent, fine particulates, also have a history, and the origins of that history can appropriately be traced to the law. In 1970, Congress enacted the Clean Air Act, the first and most significant element of an immense, decade-long legislative project that brought the environment itself into being. A central provision of the Act was the decision to set standards for so-called criteria air pollutants at levels designed to protect public health with an ample margin of safety. There was no provision for weighing the health benefits of clean air standards against the costs to industry of complying with those standards. Foiled in its attempt to read a cost-benefit test into the law, industry chose to fight the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, whose remit includes the Clean Air Act, on scientific grounds. Fine particulates emerged from the generation-long epic conflict between EPA's efforts to clean the air and industry's attempts to set the terms in which EPA might define what counts as clean air. The Clean Air Act asks EPA to set national ambient air quality standards for so-called criteria pollutants. These include suspended particulate matter, the invisible present-day descendants of the suspended soot that produced killer fogs in the first half of the 20th century. By the 1990s, EPA was aware of a public health problem that seemed not to improve despite all attempts to improve the quality of urban air. This was the increase of respiratory illnesses such as asthma, especially among inner-city dwellers. The agency and its scientific consultants set out to identify the reasons. One result was the so-called Six Cities Study, conducted by researchers at Harvard School of Public Health. This ambitious epidemiological study found that the likely agent of the nation's growing respiratory distress was an actor, or as scholars in science studies who are actor network theorists sometimes like to say, an actant, that is a non-human agent, that had hitherto escaped the discerning eye of the regulatory state, fine particulate matter. In its subsequent revision of the ambient standard for ozone and fine particulate matter, EPA included a new provision relating to fine particulates, triggering an all-out attack from the polluting industries. The ensuing legal battles focused on a single ontological question. Should fine particulates exist at all as a kind of entity that EPA or the publics it seeks to protect should care about? If sufficient doubt could be cast on their causal role in air pollution-related disease, then there would be no need to think of the air as containing these particular items suspended within it. Plato famously thought that nature was a body with joints, and philosophy's job was to find those joints and cut nature accordingly. If the six cities study did not hold up, there would be no need to divide nature along these particular joints. The very rationale for fine particulates would cease to exist. They could go the way of other now forgotten aerial kinds, like phlogiston. I will not rehearse in detail the legal and procedural battles on this issue as they played out. The conclusion was that EPA won, vindicated in the Supreme Court by one of the more collegial opinions to come out of a deeply divided court in recent years. But the much more recent 2007 decision in Massachusetts versus EPA, a challenge to EPA's refusal to act on global warming, suggests that the ontological question of what the air consists of has not left our legal decision-making. Technically, that more recent case raised two main issues. Did the state of Massachusetts have legal standing to sue the EPA on the issue of global warming? And was EPA justified in its refusal to treat greenhouse gases as air pollutants under the Clean Air Act? Justice Scalia played the naturalization card most openly on the second issue. So in the oral argument on the case, Scalia tried to draw a distinction between air pollution, plainly regulated by the Clean Air Act, and global warming, which he suggested was an effect on an atmospheric system that was not the same as air. When the Supreme Court rendered, again, a split 5-4 decision against EPA in this case and for the states that wanted more action on global warming, Scalia filed a separate dissent. He insisted on the plain meaning of the act, which in his view put global warming outside the domain of air pollution. In support of this reading, Scalia relied on the dictionary and on its monopoly on establishing the plain meaning of words. And he said, "We need look no further than the dictionary for confirmation that this interpretation of air pollution is eminently reasonable. The definition of pollute, of course, is to make or render impure or unclean. And the first three definitions of air are as follows. 1, the invisible, odorless, and tasteless mixture of gases which surrounds the earth. 2, the body of the earth's atmosphere, especially the part of it near the earth, as distinguished from the upper rarefied part. 3, a portion of air or of the air considered with respect to physical characteristics or as affecting the senses. EPA's conception of air pollution, focusing on impurities in the ambient air at ground level or near the surface of the earth, is perfectly consistent with the natural meaning of that term." But Scalia this time was in dissent. This time Scalia fought a losing battle. The air, as we know it now, has in it both fine particulates and greenhouse gases. This is not a natural fact, but a result of the Supreme Court's historic deliberations on the language of the law as written for us, the people, by the U.S. Congress. Two more short examples. The first one relates to the death penalty and the American politics around it. Relying on science, Romney files death penalty bill. With that headline, a press release on April 28, 2005, announced that the former Massachusetts governor, Mitt Romney, would seek to reintroduce by law the death penalty that the state's Supreme Judicial Court had ruled unconstitutional in 1984. The article quoted Romney as saying that his bill would provide a gold standard for the death penalty in the modern scientific age. Romney was clearly aware of the enormous success of the Innocence Project, the path-breaking effort by the civil rights lawyers Barry Sheck and Peter Neufeld to use DNA evidence to exonerate the falsely convicted. Drawing an implicit parallel between that much-admired effort and his own proposal, Romney declared, "Just as science can free the innocent, it can also identify the guilty." The bill itself deferred to science by calling for corroborating scientific evidence, multiple layers of review, and a novel, no doubt, standard of proof. As Romney said, the weakness in the death penalty statutes is, of course, the fear that you may execute someone who is innocent. We remove that possibility. But what did Romney leave out of the picture in constructing his image of a science that does not fail? First, he ignored the simple human limitations of converting physical samples into forensic evidence. People mess up. They're careless. They contaminate samples and they operate under pressure. In reproductive clinics, women have sometimes been treated with the wrong person's sperm and born the child of a father unknown to them. In public forensic labs, even more than in hospital settings, the pressure to cut corners and relax the rules are strong indeed. We have only to think of recent scandals about laxity in the U.S. Department of Agriculture's inspections of slaughterhouses and the Federal Aviation Administration's failure to enforce aircraft safety checks. Second, and perhaps more important, Romney's analysis ignored the constant pressures on crime labs to produce results that will put people behind bars and will do so on a basis that society finds reassuring. That pressure has led entire police departments to wink at persistent violations of scientific integrity and ethical corner cutting that have badly damaged the credibility of all forensic evidence. We see then that the superficial parallel that Romney drew between using DNA evidence to establish guilt and using it to reveal innocence ignored important contextual differences. When the purpose is to free a presumably innocent, wrongfully convicted prisoner, forensic scientists have every incentive to produce the most reliable and persuasive results within their power. By contrast, when the purpose is to convict the guilty, extraordinary pressures exist to produce results that will satisfy the prosecutors and the public's desire for speedy convictions. Fortunately, in this case, the Massachusetts legislature displayed some of the skepticism that we associate with robust democracy, and the Massachusetts House of Representatives unambiguously defeated the Romney bill in 2005. A Democratic representative voiced the majority's key concern. No system that relies on scientific evidence can truly be developed that flawlessly and with no doubt separates the guilty from the innocent. My final example is drawn from an as yet only emerging inchoate alliance between scientific and legal thinking, along with a particular brand of analytic moral philosophy, the coupling of neuroscience and the law. Brain imaging has made incredible strides in recent years, and we've gained powerful new techniques to place on a reliable scientific basis the kinds of deterministic statements about human thought and reasoning that 19th century phrenologists only dreamed of. Much of the new scientific work rests on our ability to make visible the centers of the brain that seem to be activated when people are engaging in particular forms of emotive or cognitive work. The middle region of the front part of the brain, for example, appears in many studies to light up when people are reacting under strongly emotional impulses. By contrast, the dorsal regions take on more work when people begin to reason, to think through a problem on the basis of rules and principles, rather than on intuition or as an emotionally conditioned reflex. These techniques are now being used to show, as experimental psychologists claim with increasing authority, that human beings are capable or incapable of making certain kinds of correct moral choices. In the typical experimental situation, the subject is presented with what philosophers call a trolley problem. Many of you will be familiar with the canonical version of that problem. A trolley is barreling down a forked track. On one branch, there are five people who will not be able to jump out of harm's way in time. On the other branch, there's only one helpless person. You, the moral chooser, can flick a switch and make the trolley avoid the five and kill the one. Which do you choose? Well, some 90% of experimental subjects in international studies say that they would flick the switch to avoid the greater harm. They would kill the one to save the five. But the situation changes radically when the facts are altered. Now, instead of flicking a switch, the experimental subject is told that there is a fat man standing next to him on a railroad bridge. Throwing the man into the speeding trolley's path will kill that one person but save the five further down the track. Now it turns out that most respondents don't like the utilitarian option. No one wants to throw the fat man to certain death. Of course, the finding is intuitively plausible to most of us, and it's interesting to learn of the games people play in the field of experimental psychology and neuroscience. But where the picture gets more interesting is when these kinds of findings are used to justify and defend a particular account of moral reasoning with implicitly normative consequences. For a corollary of the trolley problem is a set of normative implications that psychologists draw about the right way to think. This becomes clearest in accounts of what has been called the crying baby problem. In this exercise, you're asked to imagine that you're hiding in a cellar, along with your baby and a few other desperate refugees, and armed soldiers are searching house to house in the hope of finding and killing all survivors. The baby starts to cry, as babies will. Question: do you suffocate the child so that more people have a chance to live? It's a horrible example, but what psychologists find most interesting is the change that occurs in brain activity when people are forced to answer the question. At first, they avoid it. They don't like to answer it. Brain activity, strongly lodged in the emotive center at the start, moves to the dorsal region when people start to reason. To the dorsal region. From this, the conclusion has been drawn that people who are taught to reason instead of relying on instinct will make better choices. Both of my examples, last two examples, the Romney death penalty bill and the material foundations of morality presented by brain images, prompt a deeper set of questions about the relations between law and science. How tightly and in how linear a fashion can we draw the connections between is and ought? And are there risks involved when we try to base our legal instincts and judgments on a science that is perceived as independent of society's normative concerns? I want to end with a plea against linearity. I've suggested that there are deep flaws in the dominant narratives by which the law diminishes its own role and responsibility in constructing images of the world, and then bows to those graven images. Instead, I've pointed to an alternate account of the world in which the kinds of sciences we produce are always and inevitably tied to the sorts of worlds we think we want to live in, and in the case of psychology, even the sorts of people we think we ought to be. This makes an unproblematic resort to science for solutions to legal dilemmas extremely difficult. But does it leave us with unbridled relativism and no basis for moral action? I don't think so. In the few seconds remaining, I can do no more than hint at a solution that begins with making more symmetrical the attributions of both doubt and certainty between science and the law. I want to call attention to the fact that what makes science reliable is not the invocation of nature's law, but the second part of the Declaration of Independence's famous preamble, the act of giving reasons. Not because we've achieved certainty, but because we remain groping and uncertain, and therefore have to offer arguments. When I hear of the crying baby problem, I don't think there's something wrong with thinking with one part of the brain as opposed to another. I think instead of Meryl Streep in Sophie's Choice, in which a fallible human being, a mother, wrestled with a similarly impossible moral choice, and who could not have chosen right, and I think that these are tragic choices. And I think, too, of the only fat man I know of that was ever intentionally hurled onto physical space, and that was the atomic bomb named Fat Man that dropped on Nagasaki, accompanied, to my knowledge, by no preceding deliberation about alternatives through a carefully crafted trolley problem. And I think, in conclusion, that in law as in science, strength comes not from getting the facts right, but from giving and receiving reasons. It is not certainty, but doubt, both cognitive and normative, that permeates our lives, and it is our attempt to cope with doubt, using our situated, context-bound, and limited powers of reason, as well as our continual preoccupation with the quality of that reasoning, that keeps us enlightened and ultimately also human. Thank you.